Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 26th of September, these are our main stories. President Trump has promised transparency over a complaint which has triggered the launch of impeachment proceedings against him. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has addressed a rowdy parliament the day after the Supreme Court ruled that he'd acted unlawfully in suspending it. After last week's inconclusive election, the President of Israel has asked Benjamin Netanyahu to try to form a new government. Also in this podcast...
He stared along the length of his body. His colouring, from shoulders to ankles, was a pale blue, with darker blue piping around his neck and wrists, and white buttons in a vertical line right down his unsegmented thorax.
How a cockroach becomes the British Prime Minister. The writer Ian McEwan tells us how Brexit inspired his satirical novel. We start in Washington, where the White House has released details of a phone call between President Trump and his Ukrainian counterpart that has triggered a US impeachment inquiry. It shows the US president did ask Volodymyr Zelensky to look into corruption claims made against Joe Biden, the man likely to be his main presidential rival in 2020. But Mr. Trump said there was nothing untoward in that.
The press was asking questions of the president of Ukraine, and he said, no pressure. I used the word pressure. I think he used the word push, but he meant pressure, but it's the same thing. No push, no pressure, no nothing. It's all a hoax, folks. It's all a big hoax.
Well, the Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, sees it very differently.
The president of Ukraine brought up his country's need for military assistance. And immediately thereafter, the president of the United States said, I have a favor I want to ask of you. And would not let the subject go. There was only one message that president of Ukraine got from that call, and that was, this is what I need. I know what you need. Like any mafia boss, the president didn't need to say, that's a nice country you have. It'd be a shame if something happened to it, because that was clear from the conversation.
Our correspondent in Washington is David Willis.
The White House released that rough transcript of the conversation with Mr. Zelensky today. And as you mentioned, Mr. Trump asked for a favour. He urged Mr. Zelensky to talk with the US Attorney General William Barr and Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, about a potential corruption investigation linked to Joe Biden's family. And he said, according to the transcript, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Now, there is no explicit quid pro quo, but one has to bear in mind that that request from Donald Trump came immediately after the two leaders had discussed US military aid to Ukraine. And at the time of the conversation, hundreds of millions of dollars in aid money had been put on hold by the White House. Now, Democrats argue that you don't need to be explicit. They say it's a classic mobster-style shakedown, if you like. The threat was implied. Republicans, Mr. Trump among them, say there's no evidence of a smoking gun. I think the bottom line here is that it's unlikely to change the political arithmetic. Democrats have the votes to impeach Donald Trump in the House if they choose to, having assembled their evidence. That would lead, if they did go down that road, to a trial in the Senate, where the Republicans are, of course, in the majority.
Indeed. Oh, that whole process is going to take a very long time. I suppose it's important for the Democrats that they keep the public on board and this doesn't look just like a political witch hunt.
I think that's right. And I think we're seeing signs of the toll it's taking already in President Trump's demeanour at the first news conference since the impeachment inquiry was announced. He seemed weary, hurt by the impeachment inquiry, I think. He spoke more softly than usual, and he was clearly irritated that the row over that phone call took the focus away from the administration's efforts at the United Nations. But there is a feeling that there has to be some momentum to all this now. Hopefully, various members of the intelligence committees and other committees in the House will wrap up their inquiries in the next few weeks, and certainly by Christmas that there will be some sort of articles of impeachment framed on the floor of the House of Representatives, if they're to be.
David Willis with The View from Washington. But how's the prospect of impeachment proceedings likely to play around the country? The BBC's Tim Franks spoke to Whit Ayres, a political consultant and Republican pollster.
We are in many ways in uncharted waters here. What we do know is that a majority of Americans has consistently opposed the impeachment of Donald Trump. 55% in the last survey we did. Two other surveys recently show 57 and 59% against conducting an impeachment inquiry. So roughly three-fifths of American voters at this point are against impeachment. That's a similar number to the proportion who were against the impeachment of Bill Clinton in 1998. Republicans were convinced that if they went ahead and impeached Bill Clinton, that those numbers would change. But the only numbers that changed were the unfavorable ratings of the Republican Party. Republicans were persuaded that once people understood all the facts about Bill Clinton, that the number favoring impeachment would grow. The problem is that Americans understood all the facts about what Bill Clinton had done in the Oval Office with an intern, and simply did not believe that rose to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Now, the current allegations are far more serious than that, but the facts that come out about that allegation, I think, will determine whether or not a larger proportion of Americans will ultimately end up favoring impeachment.
Right. So I guess, in a sense, it's a question that we need to pause before we get an answer, because I suppose the polling that you were referring to was done before this letter or this memorandum was released, was declassified, in which we got a few more details. But in terms of, I guess, the number of swing voters who are out there, there must be some people who have yet to make up their minds about Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Are those the sorts of people on whom this could have a potentially significant impact come 2020?
Possibly, but there are very, very few Americans who've not made up their minds about Donald Trump. People have very intense views one way or the other about Donald Trump. And they tend to go into their tribal corners whenever there's another new allegation. So there would have to be very compelling new evidence about this situation to change public opinion very significantly.
That was Whit Ayres. Well, Donald Trump, of course, wasn't the only person on that now infamous phone call. So how does this look for his Ukrainian counterpart, President Volodymyr Zelensky? Jonah Fisher is in the country's capital, Kiev.
It doesn't look great from a Ukrainian perspective. Volodymyr Zelensky built his reputation, was elected on the basis that he was a bit different, a truth teller, someone who was going to shake things up a bit. In fact, this transcript, this glimpse into the way he actually operates, shows him being almost embarrassingly obsequious with Donald Trump, talking about how he stayed in Trump Tower, how that Donald Trump has got a better aeroplane with him. And perhaps most surprisingly is the detail that, in fact, Volodymyr Zelensky agreed to start or restart an investigation into the company which Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, worked for. We had previously been under the impression that it was the failure of Ukraine to start an investigation that had caused this freeze in U.S.-Ukrainian relations over the summer. In fact, it seems that in that phone call, Mr. Zelensky gave the go-ahead, said he would go ahead with some sort of investigation, and that a phone call would then take place between Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, and Bill Barr, the U.S. Attorney General. We do not then know if that call actually took place as a follow-up. It would be very interesting to know if, whether after that call ended here in Ukraine, whether Mr. Zelensky's advisers took him to one side and said, perhaps we let this quietly drop. And if that did indeed turn out to be the case, perhaps that was then the reason why relations with the United States took such a dive.
Jonah Fisher. The president of Israel, Reuven Rivlin, has asked the country's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to try to form a new government after last week's election ended in deadlock. Accepting the mandate, Mr. Netanyahu urged his rival, Benny Gantz, who's the leader of the Blue and White Alliance, to join him in a unity government. More details from our Middle East correspondent, Barbara Pletusher.
The prime minister was unable to form a governing coalition after elections in April, and it doesn't look any easier now. He has 4, possibly 6 weeks to convince other parties to back him. As he accepted the mandate, he stepped up the pressure for a broad unity government with his main rival, Benny Gantz. Polls show that's what the voters want. But the two parties failed to reach a power-sharing agreement in talks this week, and Mr. Gantz again refused Mr. Netanyahu's terms. He said his blue and white party would not do a deal with the prime minister's bloc of right-wing parties or sit in a government whose leader was facing a severe indictment. Mr. Netanyahu is particularly determined to keep his job because that would put him in a stronger position to deal with a possible indictment on corruption charges. He insists he's innocent and will be making his case at a hearing next week.
Barbara Pletusher. A BBC investigation has found that children as young as 7 are being groomed to sell sex in one of the world's largest licensed brothels. Prostitution is legal in the village of Daulatia in Bangladesh, and it's home to nearly 2,000 sex workers. Some say they were trafficked in. Others started work when they were just 11 years old. A British children's charity has set up schools and a safe home in the region to help children escape this life. But it's at a time when the United Nations is warning of a drop in overseas aid to education, which could put projects like these at risk, as Frankie McCamley reports.
Behind the bustling noise of what appears to be a normal rural village, there's a dark world where the unimaginable happens to children. A row of corrugated iron shacks surrounds one of the world's largest brothels. Selling sex is legal over the age of 18, but children are forced into this life and abused regularly. This woman, whose identity we're protecting, says she was trafficked here.
My boyfriend brought me from my village. He told me we were going somewhere else. He tricked me. Then after a few nights' stay at a madam's house, I owed her money and had to start work.
The brothel is so popular, it's grown into a village at the end of an old British railway line. The train arrives packed, bringing hundreds of new customers every single day. We're just heading into the brothel now. One woman has agreed to talk to us. We're going to find her, but in order to get there, we've got to walk down these tiny little muddy paths. It's dirty, there are open drains here, and it really smells. We've just arrived at this woman's house. We've been told we've got to wait for 5 minutes because she's got a customer with her. She works in a small room in the corner of the brothel, selling sex for around $3. Her client is still sat on the bed eating curry. He gets lunch included.
What is it like living here?
Can anyone enjoy living here? I would obviously prefer to move out. I need the money to escape.
This woman says her biggest concern is her daughter. She's now the same age this woman was when she started work.
My girl is growing up. I'm stuck here. But she has turned 11. How long has she got left before they take her?
She's worried people in the brothel will force her daughter into prostitution, which is a serious concern shared by a global children's charity. Save the Children has teamed up with local NGOs to set up schools for brothel children. They want to give them an escape route and break the cycle. The school for 6 to 11-year-olds is trying to integrate brothel children with those from other neighbourhoods. But inside the classroom, a teacher says they have to give them extra support.
Because they cannot work at home and do their homework, we have to give them more time and create extra lessons for them to do this.
We've come to a safe home where around 20 girls are being looked after. These are some of the girls that are classed as most vulnerable. Maybe some of their families could have been trying to force them into sex work.
Hi. Hello, Shimona.
How are you?
Good. How
Welcome
are you?
Welcome to our safe home.
Thank you.
Cetil, whose name we've changed, moved to the safe home when she was 9. She now works here, but tells me about her friend who she had to leave behind.
She did not want to join in, but the safe home couldn't take more children at the time. One night, her mother forcefully put a customer in her room. After he left, she hanged herself.
And even for those who make it here, it doesn't mean they're completely free from brothel life. One of the girls is just 7. Her mother keeps trying to take her back and force her to work. Only a handful make it to the safe home. Their mothers must pay towards their life here, earning money the only way they know how. The rest of the funding comes from abroad, but the future of these projects is uncertain. The money runs out next year. The UN says aid for education has dropped globally.
That was Frankie McCamley. You're listening to the Global News podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, the fight goes on for a transgender man who gave birth to be recognised as a father, not a mother.
We're not asking to eradicate motherhood. We're not asking even telling the courts and dictating how it should be labelled. We're simply asking that it reflects the genuine structure of the family. Because of course that's going to follow the child for life.
It's back to normal in Westminster, the new normal of politics in Britain, that is. A government with no majority and a parliament accused by a senior member of the government of being dead and cowardly. This was the House of Commons as MPs returned to work the day after Britain's Supreme Court ruled that the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, had acted unlawfully in suspending Parliament. Well, the fireworks started early as the government's top law officer, the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, laid into MPs.
This Parliament should have the courage to face the electorate. But it won't. It won't because so many of them are really all about preventing us leaving the European Union at all. But the time is coming. The time is coming, Mr. Speaker, when even these turkeys won't be able to prevent Christmas.
But Mr. Cox didn't have it all his own way. This was the opposition Labour MP Barry Shearman.
No shame today, no shame at all. The fact that this government cynically manipulated the prorogation to shut down this House so that it couldn't work as a democratic assembly. He knows that that is the truth. And to come here with his barrister's bluster to obfuscate the truth, and for a man like him, a party like this and a leader like this, this Prime Minister, to talk about morals and morality is a disgrace!
Meanwhile, Boris Johnson was flying back to Britain from New York overnight after addressing the UN General Assembly. When he addressed MPs, he showed no sign of remorse for the conduct that had resulted in the damning ruling from Britain's highest court and no hint of a change of tack.
I say it is time to get Brexit done. Get Brexit done so we respect the referendum. Get Brexit done so we can move on to deal with the people's priorities, the NHS, the cost of living. Let's get Brexit done so we can start to reunite this country after the divisions of the referendum rather than having another one. It's time for this Parliament finally to take responsibility for its decisions. We decided to call that referendum. We promised time and again to respect it. I think the people of this country have had enough of it. This Parliament must either stand aside and let this government get Brexit done, or bring a vote of confidence and finally face the day of reckoning with the voters.
How likely then will it be that the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, will take the bait and agree to a general election? That was a question I asked our Westminster correspondent, Naomi Grimley.
Certainly not for the moment, because Boris Johnson was goading him really to bring on a general election. And yet the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, says he'll only agree to a general election if Boris Johnson gives his word that he will ask the EU for a Brexit extension if there isn't a deal done by the middle of October. So that's the kind of deadlock that we're in now. But certainly tonight from Boris Johnson, no control for the Supreme Court incident. He says, I think they were wrong. And also this sort of taking the attack to the opposition when it comes to a general election. What are they scared of? He shouted.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? So no visible political ramifications of for what's happened for Boris Johnson. Meanwhile, he was talking about continuing trying to get this deal, this elusive deal with the European Union.
Yes, and I think there'll be controversy there too, because no sooner had he got to his feet than he was claiming that the EU are prepared to reopen the withdrawal agreement, which has been the most contentious bit of the divorce between the EU and the UK. And he claims that the negotiations are actually now going his way, that the EU are showing signs of unpicking some of the withdrawal agreement. I have to say that is contrary to everything we've heard, not only from the EU Commission, but also other member states like Ireland, which of course has a big stake in Brexit.
Naomi Grimley, the twists and turns of this Brexit saga have sometimes been so surreal. Many people have said you couldn't make it up. But Brexit has now become the inspiration for a novelist. Ian McEwan is one of the world's most successful writers. He's now created a political satire called The Cockroach, a clear nod to Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis. But in McEwan's novella, the narrator is a cockroach who wakes up and realizing he has transformed into a human, who also happens to be the UK Prime Minister. Here's a short extract, read by the actor Bill Nighy.
He stared along the length of his body. His colouring, from shoulders to ankles, was a pale blue, with darker blue piping around his neck and wrists, and white buttons in a vertical line right down his unsegmented thorax. The light breeze that blew intermittently across it, bearing a not unattractive odour of decomposing food and grain alcohol, he accepted as his breath.
The BBC's Razia Iqbal asked Ian McEwan what had made him choose this subject now.
I'd thought for a good while that the EU as a subject and Britain breaking from it seemed so vast. I had no idea how to break into it. But one day I was just doodling and I somewhat parodied or paid tribute to Kafka's famous opening sentence of The Metamorphosis. Gregor Samsa, after a night of uneasy dreams, wakes to find himself transformed into a giant creature. And I thought, well, actually, the country's gone through a kind of metamorphosis. So maybe there's a way in here, keeping the cast list very tight.
But the inversion is that a cockroach wakes up one morning to find that it has become the British Prime Minister.
Exactly so. In fact, 25 cockroaches who live in the Palace of Westminster, its generally decaying conditions suit them perfectly. They go en masse up Whitehall and some move into various ministries and occupy the bodies of the cabinet. But we focus on Jim Sams and he wakes up to find himself the Prime Minister. An aide comes in, lets him know that he's got a cabinet meeting at 9 o'clock. And we follow Jim Sams and his cabinet. They've come to really put fire in the belly of a wavering government. They want to push through. Actually, it's not Brexit. I've looked for something more absurd. It's called reversalism. They just want to reverse the flow of money so that when people go for a job, they have to pay for it. And when they go to the shops, they get paid for what they carry away.
You make no secret of the fact that you think Brexit is a crazy idea and that you voted to remain. I wonder what you would say to those people who say that you lay yourself open to those criticisms, that you, as a Remainer, have nothing but disdain for those people who voted to leave.
Oh, the people who voted to leave, I have every respect for, but I think they have been profoundly misled and indeed lied to.
I wonder what point you had got at as a public intellectual where you thought, I need to intervene in some way publicly.
Well, it's very nice of you to think of this as an intervention.
Let's see what kind of impact it makes.
I mean, in this thunderous babble of noises, I don't know if suddenly all heads are going to turn. But wouldn't it be marvellous if Boris Johnson said, well, I've read The Cockroach, and actually I now come to see that actually we'd be far off better economically and culturally in every other way if we were to remain. Then I could say that, against Auden's famous remark, that poetry does make things happen.
Do you think that those who are leading the charge in terms of Brexit, is there any seriousness in their part when they talk about the elite, of which you would have to admit you are a part of an elite who are just patronising those who have exercised a democratic right?
We are above 16 million strong, which is a meritocratic triumph, I think, in any democracy, and an elite of 16 million is an achievement. And one has to say that who leads the other side of the Brexit? There are newspaper proprietors, Etonians. It's a very old populist trick.
When you finished writing this, did you reflect on it in a way that suggested to you that you understood the polarisation that has taken place in this country?
I think I understand the process by which people came to vote for Brexit. We've had many, many years of austerity. Lots of government services have been cut back. I think they've been misled, quite an extraordinary sleight of hand, to blame Brussels and the EU for things that are actually entirely in the hands of the British state and the British government.
When you travel around the world, as you do, promoting your books, what sorts of conversations or reactions do you get from people about what is clearly a very chaotic time in this country?
If I say, as I did in northern Italy, there was an audience of 2,500 people, and I said I thought that the EU was a magnificent social, political, historical product, flawed like all human institutions, they all rose to their feet. We are discovering just how difficult it is to disentangle ourselves and how pointless. We have now reached a point, from the Remainers' point of view, when we no longer hear any economic arguments from the Brexit government. It's just become sort of mystical. We've got to have it because we said we had to have it.
There is a wonderful moment in the book when the Chancellor of Germany says to the British Prime Minister, Jim Sams, why are you doing this to your country? And his answer is pretty much what you're talking about, this kind of mystical belief.
Yes, there's one word he lands on as his explanation. He says, we're doing it because... And then he pauses again and says, because it's Italicised. And that is why we're leaving the EU, because.
The author Ian McEwan. A British transgender man who gave birth and wanted to be recognised as a father rather than a mother on his child's birth certificate has lost his case in court. He says he hopes to appeal against that decision. More details from the BBC's LGBT correspondent, Ben Hunt.
Freddie McConnell was biologically born a woman, but now lives as a transgender man. Legally recognised as a man several years ago, he was still biologically able to get pregnant and give birth. Mr. McConnell began the legal action when he was asked to register as a mother on his child's birth certificate. He'd wanted to get that status changed to that of father or parent. The judgment recognised it is medically possible for an individual whose gender is recognised in law as male to give birth. But it said the parental status, which derives from their biological role in giving birth, must be that of mother. Mr. McConnell's lawyer, Karen Holden, called the ruling a setback in the fight for trans equality.
We're not asking to eradicate motherhood. We're not asking even telling the courts and dictating how it should be labelled. We're simply asking that it reflects the genuine structure of the family. Because, of course, that's going to follow the child for life.
Mr. McConnell says he plans to appeal against the decision.
Ben Hunt reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.